Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, James Lindsay, author of Race Marxism, is here. It's a phenomenal conversation. I think you'll really enjoy it. You should text this to your friends that support the BLM regime. It's factual. It's fun. It's lighthearted. James is a really good friend. I think very highly of him. He's wise. He's courageous. He considers himself a liberal, but he's not. Support our show if you can, charliekirk.com/support. If you want to get involved with Turning Point USA, go to tpusa.com. That's TPUSA. At TPUSA, we are starting high school and college chapters all across the country. We're playing offense with a sense of urgency to win the American culture war. TPUSA.com. Start a TPUSA chapter today. We exist to pass down American values from one generation to the next. Again, email us your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com, and make sure you subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show podcast. James Lindsay is here. Buckle up. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by my friends Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage, 888-888-1172 or andrewandtodd.com. I have been really looking forward to this conversation. He's been on our show many times, and I look forward to exploring some big ideas. And I just have so much respect for this man. He's so wise and so interesting, and he has been one of the few people that has been willing to really critique the woke industrial complex. He is the author of a new book called Race Marxism, The Truth About Critical Race Theory and Praxis. What is that? Well, we're going to ask him about it. James, welcome back to the Charlie Kirk Show.
Hey, Charlie, what's up?
So first, I can't find your book anywhere except in the Kindle edition. What's that all about?
What it's about is that we're publishing it through the Amazon Direct Publishing, that through the New Discourses imprint, from my own company, New Discourses, rather than going through a big box. So that's the only option they get for pre-order. So you can pre-order the Kindle now. The paperback will be available on the 15th of February, so it's coming soon. And I have a pretend paperback here, so it really will exist. But pre-orders are Kindle only until the 15th.
Very good. Tell us about the book.
So, you know, there's no honest word about critical race theory out there. There's a lot of stuff that is critical race theory, being critical race theory, and, you know, doing what critical race theory does in its own words, within its kind of own bubble of interpretation. And then there's virtually nothing from the outside, because people who are outside of critical race theory very rarely have the interest to dig deep. Of course, it's changed over the last year or two. So there's no like truly deep dive that explains what critical race theory really is. And so I wanted to fill that niche. It's obviously the hottest topic in the world. Or one of them. I think it's one of the most dangerous subjects that we're dealing with in the world right now. So I felt like it was an important niche to fill. So it covers, what is the definition of critical race theory? How does critical race theory operate like a belief system, and what are its beliefs? Where did this come from? Where did those ideas come from, tracking all the way back to Marx and Hegel and Rousseau? And then how does it work? And then finally, what are some ideas of things we might be able to do about critical race theory since it is here?
So you have an interesting word on your cover, praxis. That's where we get our the English word practice from. What is praxis, praxeology, and why would you put that on your cover, the study of human action?
Well, it's because the Marxists use that word in place of the word practice to mean practice that is informed by their theory. And so what they actually believe, I know you said we're going to go deep. It depends on how deep you want to go. But they actually believe that if you are doing activity that's not informed by theory, then your activity is probably either illegitimate or maybe even part of the problem. And so you have to be in this kind of continual relationship with your activity. So you go out and do some activism, or you interact in the world, or you hold some beliefs within yourself, and you constantly need to be reflecting against theory, in other words, Marxian theory or Marxist theory, to better understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, and so on, and advancing that theory's implementation. So praxis is basically the word that means the implementation of a Marxist theory. And so what you see in particular is you'll see a lot of people argue that critical race theory is not being taught in schools. Yes. But the truth is that critical race praxis, which installs critical race theory ideas, is what's happening in schools. They are actually implementing critical race theory rather than teaching the theory in a detached way. And that's their little linguistic trick to get around it.
And we're seeing that at every corner. So I'll give you an example here that I want to explore with you. In Denver, you probably saw this, Denver Elementary School receives backlash for participating in Black Lives Matter Week of Action. Maybe you saw this or not. And so maybe you can explain this to me. So they have this list of 13 guiding principles that seem kind of just completely random, but not to a trained eye. So you're going to tell us why it actually makes sense. Restorative justice, empathy, loving engagement, diversity, globalism, transgender affirming, queer affirming, collective value, intergenerational, black families, black villages, black women, and unapologetically black. How do we make sense of that?
Well, there are two things to make sense of. Why is it in the schools? Well, because what critical race theory does, and what you'd find if you end up picking up Race Marxism, reading chapter five, all critical race theory does is attempts to make more critical race theorists. The religion of critical, and then put them in positions of power, I should add. The religion of Marxism in general, or of critical race theory more in specific as a kind of race-based denomination within that broader Marxist faith, believes that when everybody has the right consciousness, that they're going to use that consciousness to put action into the world. There's your praxis. And when everybody's putting the correct practice into the world, or praxis into the world, then what you're going to eventually have is the utopia. The communists called it communism, and the Marxists of today, using things like critical race theory, call it justice, which is just a euphemism for communism, as they like to do. So why are they doing this in the schools? Well, because that's all they do. They literally think that it is not just appropriate, but necessary to replace the lessons in every single subject with consciousness raising. And if it's critical race theory, it's racial consciousness raising. You mentioned queer and transgender. So you have to have the queer, gender, whole sex, sexuality universe consciousness raising in terms of that being its own Marxist approach to identity. And so what you see there is the entire grab bag under this doctrine of intersectionality, that all of the various forms of oppression, as they call it, which means communists not getting their way, have to be considered all at once in this kind of huge bucket. So you have to talk about race constantly. You have to talk about how we don't have a perfect global communist world order, because that oppresses people who are in, say, the third world, as you might say it, to the advantage of the first world. You have to talk about how, people who are held under normative expectations of sex, gender, and sexuality are being oppressed and being kept out of their ability to enter into actually what turns out to be the Marxist religious practice, which is that of transition. Transition, the process of becoming from what was to something different, is in fact the whole program. So what this is just an attempt to use identity factors and global politics and liberation politics that have always been kind of communist programs to push communism into the schools, because that's all they do. Because if they can awaken that consciousness in a new generation of kids, get them to break away from the previous culture, get them to hate their parents, get them to hate their parents' faith, get them to hate the cultural values that have built this country, then they can get that ground becomes tilled and prepared for them to have a revolution and then start a new society.
You say it's a religion. I totally agree. This sounds as if it would be like the Great Commission, like go make disciples of all nations, go lead them up in positions of authority. You call this a religion. It sure sounds like one.
Yeah, I mean, we can go really deep into how it's a religion, but that Great Commission thing is exactly right. Consciousness raising is the name of their Great Commission. And they believe that that there are two types of people, in essence. There are people who see the power dynamics that structure all of society. That's called structuralism, and that's the heart of the Marxist belief system. And then there are people who are either naive or willfully ignorant to it and don't see it. So there are the people who see it and people who don't. And what they believe is that if they can go and get people to basically be born again through the work into conscientized people, then they can have their revolution and their new world.
Well, I just find it so interesting, and I'm not going to get into your metaphysics here on the show, but you know, I wouldn't call you a Christian. Maybe you are. I don't know. The point is that you just from an objective onlooker, they've basically just kind of carbon copied the entire Commission of Christianity and incorporated it into this hyper-politicized secular religion.
Upside down.
Totally upside down. Exactly. And I find that to be so fascinating. In the coming segments, I want to ask you about Rousseau and kind of where he fits into this, one of the three social contract theorists that we talk about on the show, because there were Hobbes, Rousseau, and Locke, and they all got some things correct. Rousseau was right about some things. He was terribly wrong about others. But I'm interested, because you know the literature a lot better than I do, where he was the where he derived the most inspiration behind what we now know as CRT. I find that to be really interesting because he was a critic of commercial society. He wasn't wrong about all of it. He was right about the alienation of commercial society, but the question about human nature and all those things surrounding it, I want to explore with you. Towels are mostly garbage. They feel soft and lotiony in the stores, but you get them home and they don't absorb. Well, Mike Lindell and MyPillow found out around 2006 that towels change forever. They started importing them and adding softeners and other things that cotton that made them feel good but didn't work. He found the best towel company right here in America. They have proprietary technology to create towels that feel soft but actually work. And they're all made with USA cotton, and they come with a MyPillow 60-day money-back guarantee. It's a 6-piece set, 2-bath, 2-hand towels, 2 washcloths, made with USA cotton, soft yet absorbent, regularly $109.99, now just $39.99. Mike Lindell is a fighter. Check it out right now. Go to MyPillow.com and click on the new radio listener special and get deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the towels. Enter promo code Kirk or call 800-875-0425 for these great radio specials. MyPillow.com, promo code Kirk. Do it right now. James, tell us about Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the influence he has had on now what is known as critical race theory.
You know, it's really funny because, you know, you mentioned he's a social contract theorist and he's really well known for the social contract theory that he put forth. And there actually is a critical race theorist who recently died by the name of Charles Mills, who wrote a book in 97 called The Racial Contract that directly tries to update Rousseau's social contract theory to say that there is a racial contract in our society where all of the people who have access to whiteness silently and secretly collude. They never hear about the contract, but they all play by it. And the point of the contract is to keep whiteness up and to keep other people of other races out of access to whiteness. And this is really an extraordinary conspiracy theory that he's put forth at the heart of critical race theory. But the much more relevant, rather than social contract theory, part of Rousseau is that Rousseau became fascinated with what became known as the master-slave dialectic by looking into, he was reading, in fact, misreading, misunderstanding things that were being sent back to Europe by colonial priests who were in, say, the Caribbean or other places around the world, and they're sending back what it was like to work with the natives. And he had this idea of this very, you know, noble savage who had a completely different conception of the world. And he was obviously, as you said, he got some things right and some things wrong, but he was very sour on the idea of reason-based enlightened society.
Yes.
And thought that the problems that that Europeans were facing were a result of civilization. So he came up with this fantastical notion of creating savages made to live in cities. And this ended up being, something he really put a lot of effort into thinking about, this dialectical synthesis, we would call it now, of so-called savages and so-called civilized Europeans, both of whom should be learning from one another and kind of becoming this new averaged thing. And this ended up in the hands of the philosopher Schiller, and Schiller taught it to one of his students by the name of Hegel. And when Schiller taught it to Hegel, he used the word to describe this. He used the German word Aufheben, which means simultaneously to keep and to abolish or cancel, but also to lift up, which the Marxists translate as sublate, which means to raise to a higher level of consciousness or understanding. And so the master-slave dialectic fascination that Rousseau had, combined with his social contract ideas, combined also with his emphasis that reason is too alienating and too dangerous in that regard, and therefore that sentimentality and sincerity are better arbiters of what's true, which spawned the entire Romantic movement, which in a long arc of history led to the postmodern movement. Those pieces all kind of come together to form a lot of the philosophical underpinning that defines how critical race theory operates.
A man is born free and he spends the rest of his life in chains. Rousseau famously wrote and would say. And mm-hmm. he got some things.
How Gnostic.
I'm sorry?
How Gnostic.
Yeah, exactly.
Of him to say that.
Well, and that's one of the great tensions of Rousseau is he hated industrial society, but he benefited a lot from it, actually. He enjoyed it despite the fact that he hated it, which is a really important point that I want to explore with you in the next segment that is we could go really deep into the philosophy of it, but I want to kind of connect all this with a theme of white liberals that have been pushing the kind of cocktail conversation of Black Lives Matter until all of a sudden their kid doesn't get to Princeton. I want to get to that because it really does kind of buttress up against kind of the Rousseauian hypocrisy because he's there, you know, whining and dining in Geneva, Switzerland, while he's telling everyone to stop, you know, enjoying the benefits of a market society. But let me just ask you this in the last minute, which is, so he started Romanticism. Some people would say that. How does that connect with kind of the pathological elements of CRT?
Well, that's a long, long answer. I can give you a really quick thing. The really quick thing, and this is not the main part of the story, is that Romanticism inspired existentialism, mm-hmm. inspired structuralism, inspired postmodernism through post-structuralism. So you have the postmodern element. The other side is that Romanticism inspired this subjective-based, you create the world
Bingo.
Mentality
That's
William
exactly
Blake
right.
took up.
That's so
And
right.
then that Marx took up, and Marx's theology is based in that idea that you as subject create the object in the world outside of it and come to know yourself. Critical race theory calls this the work, just like Marx referred to it as productive work. And it's done with the racial dialectic now instead of the dialectic across economic class.
That you did it in a minute. You don't need an hour.
I did it.
You did it.
Both sides.
And you said it perfectly. You said that he really started subjectivity in a clinical sense, right? He introduced it. He theorized it. He wasn't the only one. There were some thinkers before him in a more political standpoint like Machiavelli who just cared about power, where Rousseau definitely cared more about emotion and feelings and a more pathological or pathos way of looking at it. As you know, most of corporate America is going woke, and that includes companies who are investing your hard-earned retirement money. Well, guess what? I have finally found a financial planning and investment firm that supports our values. PAX Financial Group is headquartered in San Antonio, Texas. And here's the great news. Now you don't have to live in Texas to work with them because San Antonio is a military city. They have clients worldwide. I met this guy. He's super great. I think you should check it out. The thing that I like about PAX Financial Group is that they have biblical responsible investments. These investments screen out companies that promote abortion, pornography, alcohol, drugs, gambling, and are anti-family or anti-Christian. Look, if you have $150,000 or more in your IRA, 401ks, or other investments and want to speak with my friends at PAX, visit paxfinancialgroup.com. That's paxfinancialgroup.com. Right now, they want to offer you a free ebook to learn about biblical responsible investing. Grab this ebook right now at paxfinancialgroup.com, and let's start investing in companies that makes everybody's liberty a priority. So, James, when we look at political movements, we look at these sort of cultural movements, you always try to find the base. You say, "Who? What group of people are really making this happen?" And I think if we look at the BLM CRT base, it's not the black population that is the driving force of this. There's a fair amount of support here and there, but it sure seems to be financed, supported, driven forward, and endorsed mainly by upper class miserable college-educated white liberals, specifically white liberal women. Am I right?
You are pretty much right. I'll tell you, it's funny because I get called racist because I oppose CRT on the internet. I get called racist all the time. So I'll tell you what I did for Martin Luther King weekend. I got invited to speak at a conference in Franklin, Tennessee, where I was the only – this is a Martin Luther King-themed conference on the weekend preceding Martin Luther King Day. I was the only white solo speaker invited to the conference. And after I spoke, I had all these black women come up to me, laying hands on me, praying protection over me, you know, all of this. And they think that critical race theory is of Satan, and they're probably right. And so what you see actually is that the statistics are that it is white, especially it skews female, educated liberals who are the driver of this thing. They are the ones who have been captured by the Marxist ideology, and they are the ones who are pushing it, using race as the thing that they are absolutely most inflamed about, unless it's masks and vaccines.
So then let's take that a level deeper, because you look at, so let's just take ruling class exhibit A, Chuck Schumer. Okay, so Chuck Schumer, he just says what he needs to say, all this sort of stuff. Let's say Chuck Schumer's grandson wants to go to Yale or Princeton. I don't think the Schumer family will be happy if they lose out to some kid from the from Brooklyn because he's black. At what point does all of a sudden the white ruling class or the white upper middle class that has been pushing this all of a sudden maybe realize that they might be harmed or their children might be harmed or their financial interests might be harmed? Have they ever thought that through?
Well, they won't be because they get positioned as allies in this power struggle. And so allies means that you're on the correct side of this. It's if you look at it kind of from the Maoist perspective, where he creates all these demonized identities and then gives you, you know, good revolutionary identities you can get into to get out of that problem, becoming a so-called ally moves you into a revolutionary identity. So as long as people like Chuck Schumer and so on keep doing what they're doing, their kids are not going to be threatened. Now, your average middle class and even upper middle class white person is probably going to be threatened. Certainly, we're looking at it right now with the Supreme Court that if those people are Asian, it's super being threatened. But you have to understand that these elite universities like Harvard and Princeton and Yale and so on need to be best understood as hedge funds that are betting on kids. And what they care about most of all is how moldable those kids are to ideology and how socially connected their families are. That's ultimately all they really care about. And so the game is really to bring in ideologically moldable kids. Anybody who says they're an ally is obviously ideologically moldable, and who are in well-connected families, because that's what they're actually hedging on so they can keep their endowments growing. It's a very crooked, very corrupt system in these elite colleges and universities. So those people actually don't have to worry. Now, your average upper middle class white liberal should be worrying, but won't, because that would be racist. And they've been cowed into fear about worrying about the realities of what they're supporting, or they're just completely naive to the realities of what they're supporting, or some combination of both.
So are the CRT people, are they explicit about trying to play into people's white guilt? And where does white guilt come from? That's a religious question when you really think about it. How does one deal with guilt, right? You know, from the Christian faith, of which I am a believer, there's a very specific way to deal with guilt, to deal with sin, right? And the Catholic tradition has a way to deal with it through the Eucharist or through confession, the evangelical world through worship, through praise, and through asking the Lord for forgiveness. And that's a big deal, because how you deal with guilt basically explains a lot of how your society functions. Talk a little about white guilt. It's something I'm really interested in.
Yeah, it is actually. Obviously, the title of Shelby Steele's book, White Guilt, points you in his direction if you really want to understand the mechanism that he identified as well. A lot of people, just to say it, think that Shelby Steele wrote a book called White Guilt Must Be Woke. He's conservative.
He's great.
And he's saying that as a black radical from the 70s and the 60s, that he, you know, participated in the extortion side of this racket and then came to understand it. And so they are manipulating guilt. What I've actually realized, and I saw it more because of the COVID, the masks, the vaccine bullying and all of this, saw it more from there than I did originally in CRT, but now I see how it applies in both. What I noticed is that if you want to affect a tyranny, if you want to make a tyranny come about, the best way to do that is to take some category of people who are kind of not aware of really what's going on. They're actually somewhat low information, who are very proud of themselves, but most importantly, that they're very comfortable.
Yes.
They are comfortable. They are ensconced. They're wrapped in cotton and wool, and they have no idea. They've not bounced around off the world. And then you make them really, really scared that they're going to be, you know, a disease vector, or they're going to die of a disease. That's the COVID side. Or that they're racist. And then you give them a way to absolve themselves, like you said, of that guilt by enacting the practices, the cult practices that you want them to enact. So maybe it's that they're going to go yell at people who aren't vaccinated and make sure they can't come into the establishments. They're going to apparently say Black Lives Matter and punch a black guy in an elevator for not wearing a mask at the same time because they're scared of that. Or maybe it's that they're going to go around and call everybody else racist, lest anybody discover that they're not totally racially pure, or that they're not secure in the fact that they can deal with other people. And so that's how you mobilize a mass that actually will do your bidding for you. You find the most comfortable group of people and you make them scared or morally sickened with themselves and whip them into a frenzy, and then give them a set of activist practices that they can do that absolves that guilt, rather than if it's confession, repentance, Eucharist, etc. You know, the religions actually did a great job of coming up with ways, well, in most cases, of dealing with the facts of actual guilt. And this, as a religion, has its own mechanism for doing so, which is that you have to become an activist. You must engage in praxis. You must adopt theory.
Yes,
you have to,
so
quote unquote,
true.
Do the work.
Yeah. So yeah, do the work, become an ally, do the praxis. That is the CRT's Eucharist. That's their equivalent of going to church, going to mass. That's the equivalent. It's so funny. We have the cut actually ready. Cut 88 is the white liberal women screaming at the black person about the mask. We had it queued up. I was going to play it anyway. So play the tape.
Get out.
Get out.
Yo,
stop.
Get out.
Get out.
What are you guys doing?
Get out.
Get out. What are you guys doing?
Get out.
What's wrong with
get
you?
Get out. Don't touch me.
Don't you have to.
Do not touch me.
Get out.
Do not touch me.
Get out. I'm not touching you.
Do not touch
me. Oh, did you just hit me? Did you just hit me?
You just hit me.
You just hit me. You too.
Black lives matter.
Yo,
black
this
matter.
Is racist.
Wow.
Black lives matter. Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
Yo, stop! Stop recording. I don't know you. Yo, you need to stop.
Get out!
No, I'm not getting out. I was
yes,
here.
Yes, you
first.
Are.
Modernity is awesome.
Yeah, well, have, postmodernity.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's the stuff of fantasy novels. I want to ask you a question though, because that was a really interesting thing. Which it goes to a broader point that we could spend a whole hour on, which is an essay I wrote that is This Matters More Than That, trying to unpack the hierarchy of the oppression of the collectivists. And it's not really clear what matters more than that, because at that moment, those people are obviously liberals. So they know the incantation, right? So they know the Nicene Creed, which is Black Lives Matter. But the thing that mattered most at that moment was the medical industrial complex, right? So all of a sudden, medical tyranny, instead of saying, you know, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, at that moment, it's like, you're not wearing your mask. So explain that for me, James. Have you seen in certain instances, I certainly have, certain things take a temporary, maybe permanent place in the hierarchy above the hyper-racialization of America?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The vaccine thing was pushed super hard and played into deep existential fears by the narratives that they threw out. You remember they gave us these models that, like, I think everybody was going to die. I actually got told by somebody in person who's an educated guy with an advanced degree that if we didn't all get vaccinated, and of course this is fake news, this is misinformation if you believed it, but he actually told me that if we didn't all get vaccinated very soon, that within 5 years, 99% of the population would be dead, which I don't understand how that works, because the survival rate of the virus itself is incredibly higher
and
than 90%.
You keep on having 9%. Children too. How does that even work? It's just, yeah.
And so it turns out that fear is stronger than guilt in terms of the being able to whip somebody up. You take a that video, in fact, is where you see that comfortable that set of people who have been comfortable their entire lives, they've been given existential fear, they've been made very uncomfortable, and that apparently hitting somebody and overriding their racial guilt issues while invoking the Black Lives Matter magic spell simultaneously for no apparent clear reason. Like, you can tell there's clearly no logic behind what's going on now. It's just acting out of fear. But they know that if they can bully somebody into wearing a mask, getting away from them, et cetera, then they are taking an action that absolves them of that fear that they have. Fear is actually stronger than guilt. The vaccine has been and all of the different weird COVID demands and policies have actually taken up a higher position. And it's, of course, unveiling a lot of contradictions, like the vaccine passports actually impact black and brown, if you will, people far more than they do white people on average. And so now we've literally recreated medical segregation, not just of so-called people who have not yet got vaccinated. I don't call them unvaccinated because vaccinated is not the default. They're people who did not get vaccinated. They're people by default. Is that so complicated, really? But I even forgot my point that I was going to make. I see with that, though, that, you know, there are all these behaviors that you have to take against those people in order to absolve your fear. And this is exactly how you affect a tyranny. Critical race theory does it with race, gets that existential guilt going about or even generational guilt going. But with the vaccine stuff, you have the exact same model that people have now been primed for. Be very tribal. You're either with us or against us. You're either fighting this, resisting 100%, or you're complicit. That entire mentality that's been mainstreamed through these critical theories for a while now, especially the last year and a half, has now been completely attached to vaccine policy, mask policy, et cetera, as though these people are, you know, saving not just themselves, but the world in the process. There's a COVID zero false hope or faith that's driving them. And it's ultimately a fear-based religion. And so it's higher up in the hierarchy right now.
Look, it's a new year and not much has changed. We have inflation. Houses are selling in a week, interest rates are at zero, and our government is still borrowing money, well, actually printing money. $5 trillion in new money, to be exact. What could go wrong? Meanwhile, consumer confidence hits a 10-year low, inflation 6.8%, even higher in certain places, 10%, 12% in other places. Something is not adding up. So what can you do? Well, you can play it safe. Put some of your assets into precious metals, will keep your money away from volatility of the markets, and will let you sleep at night. This month, Noble Gold is giving away a free 1/10 of an ounce solid gold American Eagle coin with any qualifying plan you start. So talk to an expert at Noble Gold, and they'll run through the options for keeping your money safe. No pressure, no hassle, no call centers, just a chance to speak to someone who knows what they're talking about for once. How refreshing would that be? Call us at 877-646-5347 or visit our website at noblegoldinvestments.com. That's noblegoldinvestments.com. James, what is the trans queer intersectionality of all this? I can't quite make sense of this.
That's the hot mess, man. So trans is obviously something that's going on within the broader umbrella of queer theory. Queer theory is just another dimension. Critical race theory is one dimension of identity Marxism, as we might call it, or woke Marxism. Queer theory is another dimension. It looks like it's different, but it's actually exactly the same. Instead of using race, it uses sex, gender, and sexuality as or anything non-normative, as it's so mental illness, for example, as its places that it does its operation. And so the definition of queer means it is literally an identity without an essence. That's Halperin's definition of queer, which means that it is an identity that is not defined in and of itself, but is defined in opposition to anything that's considered dominant, normal, normative, expected, or commonplace. So if there are, you know, men and women are two sexes that are different from one another and they're complementary in whatever ways, we could get biblical about that straight from the very beginning of Genesis if you want. We don't have to. However you want to view that, I mean, it could be biology, it could be, it's just an obvious fact. Well, that becomes normal to think, and therefore queer has to resist that by its definition. So it's like an identity that's an anti-identity. It's anything that might be solid.
Well,
must
but
be made
here's
liquid.
My question, though, James. And we only got 3 minutes, and I don't know if can we. What's the studio? Can we go over a little bit?
I can do it.
Yeah, can you stay like an extra 10 minutes?
Anything you need
on top of the radio? This is a really important thing, and this is the tension that I don't understand. They say black identity matters, all while simultaneously saying that you could choose your own identity. What? Which is it? It is inherently contradictory. It's either identity
is
real and objective reality, or it isn't.
It is, but these are left and right hands of the same beast, and they actually theorize identity differently because they see what's causing the imposition of identity is different. So with queer theory, reality itself is imposing identity, so they have to reject that. With critical race theory, they say that the races are socially constructed categories that are being imposed by white people who want to keep their power base. So that's what you have to resist. So in essence, they're actually the same thing, but you cannot choose your racial identity because your racial identity is determined for you by the power dynamics being put out by white people according to the doctrine of whiteness that they have. And then with queer theory, you can choose and in fact must choose your identity because otherwise people who believe in biology are trying to enforce an identity upon you. And so that's where the imposition of identity comes from. And the imposition of identity is the thing that's limiting your subjectivity. To go back to the Marxian theology, your subjectivity is being limited, thus your ability to create the objective world in which you inhabit and know yourself as its creator is limited, and that's considered arbitrary. So that's where you resolve the tension, but in practice, you see this clear contradiction, you see this clear struggle, and then you see this clear fight, as you mentioned before the break, with like Dave Chappelle. He apparently used his white privilege, the article tells us, because he made jokes about trans people. And to just point out then what you obviously can derive from all of that is that none of this is meant to make sense. It is all meant only to exert control and power over people that are saying and doing things you don't want them to do, using any tool, calling them racist, accusing them of whatever other evil that you can possibly do in order to get that control.
You explained it better than anyone else that I could think of. I still am confused by it. And you understand why I'm confused, because it is like a subjective, objective kind of tension where part of their whole thing is like, what matters is that we are black and that is who we are, and you can't be black and we're in the cool kids club. Okay, fine, whatever. That's weird and racist. All the while being like, hey, anyone can change their gender to be anything they want to be, and there's no such thing as objective identity. Who am I to say? It's like in the same kind of sentence, it's an inherent contradiction, and your point is a great one. It's supposed to be confusing. It's not supposed to make sense. It's not Newtonian physics, right? This is a mess. It's a hurricane. It's a dumpster fire. So did what I say make sense? This kind of our identity really matters. By the way, your identity could be anything you want it to be, because they don't believe in transracialism, but they believe in transgenderism.
Right.
How is that possible?
Okay, so what you said does make sense, but I need to break this down to you. Like, I had a good grasp on it, but now I have a really good grasp on it in just the past couple months. And so I'm going to go backwards in history a little bit to Marx. And so Marx has this belief that what you are doing is that you are a man within a continuum of history that began when man started to bootstrap himself out of being an animal by doing productive work. So work is what makes where you picture the product of your work in your mind, then you bring it into reality and come to know yourself as a creator. In case you wondered if it's a heresy against Christianity, obviously, yes. Okay. So what that does is it creates what he said is social relations, because you have all these different people doing that, some of whom become dominant over others by getting them to work for them. So if I hire you, you are not bringing your vision of the world into being anymore. You're bringing mine into being, and I give you money, but obviously it's not worth it because I've stolen your path to spiritual renewal and realization. So I'm exploiting you. And so you're bringing my vision into reality. And it sounds like this isn't going to be connected to any of this, but what this creates is a superstructure of people who dominate and an infrastructure of people who produce. And those are in what he calls dialectical tension with one another and create a structure to society. And that structure of society actually determines what society looks like at that stage of history. History is, in fact, the trajectory of all of those structures of society unfolding as they progress toward a utopia, when all the contradictions inherent in there are resolved and everybody is of one collective, unified social mind, socialist mind, or communist mind. And so what does this have to do with critical race theory and queer theory, and how does it make them the same? It turns out that identity is constructed by that structure, which is created by the social relations that they believe are the only real interpretation of anything. So what doesn't matter, is it race, is it sex, gender, sexuality, everything? It's all socially constructed. In other words, it is a matter of these social relations between people who have power and people who don't have power. And so with the identity question, identity Marxism, what it actually boils is very simple when you understand it. What it boils down to is that structure is imposing your identity on you one way or another. So with race, the white people created white supremacy to justify their access to whiteness and the exclusion of all others. So race is imposed. And Kimberly Crenshaw says that identifying as a minoritized race or black becomes an anchor for your subjectivity, so you can participate in this Marxist creation project for yourself. What's happening in queer theory is that they don't believe that material reality is anything except the social relations limiting the range of your subjectivity. Michel Foucault referred to it as expanding the potentialities of being to challenge this. So you were born, say, with male genitalia, XY chromosomes, et cetera, and your doctor imposed maleness on you by assigning your sex at birth. And so you have now had your identity imposed upon you by belief in that reality being objective and outside of yourself, rather than your subjective identity being central. And so you get to enter, if you believe in this religion, into a dialectical process of transforming or transitioning,
or metamorphosis,
by recognizing your subjectivity is first. And so your resistance against that which has been imposed upon you, whether in race or in sex, gender, sexuality, or mental illness, disability status, fat status, et cetera, that becomes your anchor of subjectivity through which you can do the work and start to become more and more and more so-called social man, at the enlightened end of history. So it really is the same thing, but you have to understand that they believe that everything is imposed upon you by the social relations that limit your range of imagination, basically, and that expanding that by resisting whatever's been imposed on you is the relevant way to go.
Yeah, I see that. I just still see a contradiction inherent.
Well, there is a contradiction, but it's because they decided to use race by I'm going to embrace my race and throw it back at you.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. That makes sense. Yeah. So yeah. Let's talk a little bit about something that people ask all the time. What do these people want? And this is where really Hegelianism, I think, is really important to build out. We don't have to go too deep into the phenomenology of spirit. I've never read Hegel. You have. You've read it for me, and that's it. People say, I've read Hegel. He made the simple complex. The best thinkers make the complex simple, like you. Big difference. But he definitely changed history. Get it? Because someone asked me, they said, Charlie, can you explain Hegel in a minute or less? No, but here's just kind of a summary. Whenever you think of Hegel, just think of history. It's that simple. He looked at things as a historical trajectory towards what? Talk a little bit about that, because there is something that people struggle with. Everyday people, they hear it. They're like, okay, that's fine. But do these people really believe this? What do they want? What's their end game, James?
Well, what they want is power to enforce their consciousness on the world. Because if you wanted a little bit more fleshed out summary of Hegel, and Marx takes off from Hegel, and all of this kind of flows from there. Hegel's idea is that nothing is, everything becomes. So there you have it in four words. Nothing is, everything becomes.
That's so good.
Right? And so a God that is, I am the I am the Alpha, the Omega. No. God becomes. And how does it become? Through the thinking and life processes of human beings doing the work. They start within their subjective view, their idealistic view for Hegel, their analysis and interpretation of their material conditions for Marx. They create what they envision in the world from their mind, and they come to know themselves through their own production, the object they create. So they start as subject, have a vision for an object, create the object, and they in fact make themselves their own object. They make society their own object. They make the human species its own object that they are doing the work on. And so everything's in a state of becoming. Now they believe that if we all get on board with this and we all do it correctly and we all do it long enough, and if it's enforced strongly enough, that eventually all the contradictions between all of these different perspectives of subjective ideas will eventually resolve themselves, and we will immanentize an eschaton, a very religious concept. We will enter into a state of perfection where the state is no longer relevant.
Which they call the synthesis, right?
Exactly. We'll enter total synthetic, perfect reality. Like the Matrix, that was the utopia that they said in the movie crashed because the humans rejected it. Even the Matrix, which is extremely critical theory oriented, understood that this is a disaster in the making. So that's the basic idea. So what they want is as many people to believe their faith as possible, this dialectical becoming faith where nothing is, the world is becoming, mankind is becoming, you are becoming, God is becoming. God doesn't know himself until his creation reveals himself to himself in the Hegelian religion. And Marx takes God out. He says that's mystical nonsense, and puts man in himself that creates himself as the deity. And so man, that's satanic, by the way. That's Lucifer. Like, I read enough of the Bible to know there's your Lucifer. That was Marx. And so they believe that when you get enough people who have that consciousness that all believe that we're in this process of becoming together, then we're on the road to literally, they put this in their own – like Marx said it, Marcuse said it, that we're going to get back into the garden because they view God as a false god who is a jailer, and that we can become like that god, throw him out of Eden, and we can get back into Eden, as Herbert Marcuse says in Eros and Civilization, by taking another bite of the fruit of the tree of knowledge.
Man, there's so much there to
unpack. No kidding.
Well,
imagine my life right now.
So when you look at Hegel and you look at the process through history, he really adopted a Christian concept of the eschaton, because we as Christians believe history has a rhythm to it, has a plan that is progressing. A form of Christian thinking that was heavy emphasis on this is called dispensationalism, which is a very structured of different types of time when God comes and dispenses his grace on his people. So I'll never forget, James, I was having a debate with Vaush. That's his name, right? Vaush on Tim Pool's show. And we got into Hegel. And before the entire audience fell asleep, we've kept it interesting. And he immediately was like, oh, yeah, I think he was totally right. It's like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, don't – he asked me. He said, Charlie, don't you think things are getting better? Don't you think that we're progressing towards like things that are so awesome? I said, you really do believe this, don't you? And it was such an eye-opening thing for me, James, because there was – whatever. I wouldn't consider him a thinker, but we had a decent conversation. He was like, no. All of this tension, all of this collision, this antithesis and thesis and the – and what do you call it? The struggle, the arc bends towards justice. It was really – it was really instructive for me. And you could call it utopia. You could call it heaven on earth. But there is a belief by some of them that they can usher that in.
Oh, yeah. They totally believe that. And the thing is – the arc of history does bend toward, we'll say, progress when you have the correct principles that enable that to happen. When you are actually according, Christians would say, when you're according with God's law or God's will.
Yes.
People outside of the tradition might say when you are doing what actually works, which, of course, the Christians would say is what has been ordained by God.
There you go. It's the Hegelians. I'll take both, by the way, just to be clear.
Sure. Yeah. They're
interchangeable.
Two conceptions of, yeah, they're very close to the same thing. And so the Hegelians don't believe that. They believe that God created the world other to himself so that he might come to know himself. And within the world, he brought the divine idea onto earth. The exact quote is, the state is the divine idea as it exists on earth. So in the Hegelian Trinity, the state replaces Jesus, which that's intense. And then that creates a spirit that informs people until the contradictions build up. And then you have this revolution. But if you look at the trajectory of real history without some kind of an ideological overlay and eisegesis and kind of interpretive terms stuck on it, what you do not see an arc, a steady arc of progress. You see forward movement. You see backwards movement. When the principles are right, people flourish. People do better because they're getting closer to what works. But when they get it wrong, you end up with 100 million dead people in China.
No, but that's part of the tension, James. You see that?
Exactly. That's their theodicy. That's why evil works, is because people decided that they didn't quite have the full enlightenment. So they installed, rather than installing a true social mentality, a true socialist idea, they installed a state capitalism, which is still at its heart capitalist, and therefore ran rampant over everything. That's what they criticized Lenin for, who said you need a state capitalism so you can feed the dialectic through that stage to get to the other side. And so they have a perfect explanation that ends with real communism has never been tried for every one of their calamities, that it's just working out the dialectic, no matter how many people have to die, because what's another Hegelian sentence? That history uses people and then discards them.
That's dark. I want to ask
you. It's real dark.
I want to ask you about a thinker that we've been spending a lot of time on here. I believe he started the Enlightenment. You might disagree. You might think it was Spinoza or somebody else. It's Machiavelli. I believe Machiavelli was the beginning of the Enlightenment, when basically he argued we can forget these ancestral traditions of Aristotle and Plato and Socrates. We don't need the thinkers of antiquity. We know what we want. Let's just get what we want. In some ways, he was the modern theorist of power dynamics. I don't know if you agree with that. I don't know if you touch on Machiavelli at all. I'm just curious your thoughts.
I don't talk about Machiavelli in this book, but as far as the Enlightenment goes, I hate to do this because this is what the critical theorist type people do. The left does this. The Enlightenment spreads out over a lot of different times and has a lot of different ideas. This is also, by the way, relevant to the Martin Luther King question about is, you know, his character versus color characterization. It's, you know, they say it's white people hold that up, you know, believe in content of character rather than color of skin, and judge that way. They cherry pick him for that. The same kind of thing is happening here. There actually were multiple things that are referred to as different enlightenments. There was a British Enlightenment or Scottish Enlightenment,
that's
French
correct.
Enlightenment,
yes.
That's Rousseau. There's a German Enlightenment, which is all this kind of like idealistic idealism.
Immanuel Kant came out of that.
Idealistic philosophy, Kant, et cetera, critique of pure reason, yada, yada, yada. And of course, Machiavelli would fit within this kind of broad sweeping set of different Enlightenment movements. But the one that mattered, The one that mattered was the Scottish Enlightenment, the British Enlightenment that Rousseau was at war with. And that one was not based in just raw, naked power struggles. It didn't embrace everything to do with what Hobbes had to say either. They were in this kind of, you know, constant brutal struggle. The Scottish Enlightenment was based off of people like Locke, for example, who understood that there is this thing, and Hume, of course, that there is this liberty available. And of course, by the way, with Hume and Rousseau, I don't know if they had like a lover's spat. I don't know what happened, but they got in this huge fight and Rousseau decided he hated him. And then all of a sudden reason and logic are bad and emotion is good. So, you know, read into that what you want. I don't know what the nature of their friendship was. Maybe it wasn't a relationship, but I'm just saying it was after their fight that he all of a sudden said sentiment and sincerity is more important than reason. But with like Locke, you're really looking at, in particular, the idea that people can be free. And if you go back to what their endowed rights or their natural rights are, what are those? You know, well, the ability to pursue their own happiness was very important for him. So he talked about, well, the only way you can really do that is through having your life protected, your liberty protected, and your property protected. Because if they can't kill you, they can't jail you, and they can't depose you from your means of living in modest comfort, then they can't really control what you say, what you want to do with your time, how you want to engage in business, who you want to associate with, et cetera, et cetera. And so this Scottish Enlightenment, especially on that political front, is really the thing that changed the world and that has made the illusion that Vaush gets to dip into that isn't stuff just getting better. Because for a very long arc now, it in many ways has. Not always. I mean, we've got some degeneracy going on these days with the internet that's a problem. But in many ways, things have actually become better. And even with around that degeneracy, you know, there can be productive uses of some of the things that tip into that that do enable greater amounts of freedom when the responsibility is paired with it, that the founders and people like Locke believed were going to be there in a moral people. So that's an anomaly that's caused by having got some conditions right for once. And it's not a guarantee. It's not that everything's just another dialectical warfare figuring out and that there's some utopia at the end. No, it's always trade-offs. It's always a mess. It's always a republic only if you can keep it. And only under such conditions do you really get this, you know, illusion of a progressive era.
That's so perfectly put. And you're right. There was kind of this piling on of different power thinkers. That's not well put, but you know what I mean. They were all they're all theorizing of who could be in, and Machiavelli really kind of started that off. We like Machiavelli on this show because obviously in the political space, so much of what he wrote is playing out around us, especially the subjectivity aspect of it, which is that, you know, power for power's sake is actually something desirable. Okay, so we have like 5 minutes, then I have to go to a meeting. But James, what can people do about this? This is, I ask you this all the time. They feel so helpless. They feel as if this is like Great Reset, globalism, CRT, woke industrial complex. I'm going to go to concentration camp soon if I don't comply. Like, people feel super confused. Distill it down to action points.
You know, it depends on what you're doing. But what you need to do is you need to be aware that this is real and that you have to do something. That's step one. We've all talked about that. Don't let the lie come through me. You have to stop lying. You have to resist the lie. I just went to Chicago. They have a vaccine mandate. I refused to tell anybody whether or not I had the vaccine. I would show nobody any vaccination card. And they said, we'll have to treat you like you're unvaccinated. And I was like, I don't care. I'm not telling you what I am.
Good
I just
you.
Resisted that. And I put on Twitter that I had this big, long set of reflections. And I said, you know, so I ate dinner alone in my room because I wasn't allowed anywhere. I couldn't get into anything. And I ate as a man. Because I didn't participate. I didn't take a vaccine card. I didn't get a fake vaccine card. I didn't participate. I just said, no, I'm not, whether I'm vaccinated or not is irrelevant. I'm not participating in this. And I ate with my own dignity fully intact. And it was a great meal. Perfectly happy to sit by myself and eat, to not participate in evil. So don't let the lie come into the world through you. Again and again, if you're being asked to lie, to service this or to be nice or to look respectable, don't do it. You don't have to be a jerk. But just don't lie to fit in. It's so important. Secondly, you have to make yourself available to other people and to show that you are willing to have this conversation, that you're willing to talk about, to doubt some of this stuff. And then what you can do is gather and get organized. You have to make the information your own. I hate to tell you, I've been saying this for 3 years. There's no other way. You actually have to learn enough of this to know what's happening so that you can resist it. You don't have to become an expert in the theory like a few of us can do. You have to find your own way, but you do have to internalize some of the knowledge of what's happening. And then you can take smart action. A lot of that's going to be to resist by getting active locally and creating areas. Like, look at what, how much of a thorn in the Biden administration's side Florida has been. And now Virginia is being. And so you get a couple of these kind of local states, just two states now, putting a real thorn, Ken Paxton, of course, in Texas, suing. You put these thorns in the sides of these big powers. They really don't know what to do. The way that a tyranny is usually brought down is through sand in the gears. Sand in the gears means small pockets of resistance that are making things difficult, expensive, onerous, time-consuming, and you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it and cause that courage to expand outward. So, you know, get people together, get organized, get informed, own the knowledge, and take action in an organized fashion. Stop basically being Leroy Jenkins and running in and smashing yourself against the machine. Start being smart, start getting organized, start thinking local, get on, you know, any kind of local political board. I just saw the new district map of Florida where they completely ungerrymandered it. It's crazy beautiful. It's the first one I've ever seen that makes sense. These kinds of things can be done by getting people at the local level, starting to take action, working up to the state level, and to just resist this stuff. It's actually empowering and it feels great. You think it's all terrible and awful, but stop doom scrolling too. And by the way, the most important thing people can do, the action step, is turn off the news. Stop watching corporate news. It is a psyops. They've said that they were testing psyops techniques through the news, at least in Canada. The Canadian military was doing it to its citizens. You know what was happening in the United States as well. There were articles that came out and said, well, psyops, those are very important. You know, they're a very valuable thing. Stop watching the news. It's poison. It is meant to keep you confused and compliant. And then, you know, civil disobedience. I heard in New York City, people are doing sit-ins about the vaccine mandates. So it's nonviolent. You go in, serve me, and I'll leave. Refuse to serve me, and I'll sit here till you do something to force me out, in which case we're going to make sure there's a video on the internet of what a bunch of tyrants you are, and just keep putting them in that position. And we actually can win this. Keep making fun of them also, by the way. These people cannot stand to be made fun of. Make fun of the World Economic Forum. Make fun of any company that partners with them. I mean, viciously make fun of them for being partnered with it until the spell starts to break for some of them.
I couldn't agree more. They can't take humor because they take themselves so seriously. And guns up, let's do this, Leroy Jenkins, is not the most prudent way to go and fight the culture war. Lech Walesa famously said, we have enough martyrs. What we need is victories. And that's very wise because there's some people that say, I'm going to fight the culture war by getting banned from YouTube. I'm like, that's totally stupid. Like, if you get banned because you said something that's true as a byproduct, it's fine. But don't seek martyrdom. Like, we got enough of that. Okay.
I mean, that's what Neil Young just did, and look at us laughing at him.
Oh, he's a joke. Joe, we are on Team Rogan here. I have so much respect for that man.
I just went on Rogan last week.
I know.
Week, so
I got to listen to it. I got to listen. How long was your episode? 6.5 hours?
No, 3:15.
Oh, well.
But it's a good one.
It was a short little gallop through the meadow. But you bring up something super important as kind of just the end point, which is tyrants get tired. You have to remember this. Tyrants get tired. They get exhausted when they get overwhelmed. It seems as if they'll never break, but it happens like Ernest Hemingway said it would. Happens gradually and then suddenly. That's how tyrants break. And so all of a sudden it's this – and it goes down. You're seeing that in Canada and all across the world. James, Race Marxism, I wish we had more time. You're terrific. And thank you so much for the time and thanks for what you're doing for our country.
Absolutely, Charlie. Talk next time.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email me directly, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thank you so much for listening. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.